space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life, a new civilization, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Greetings, salutations, and welcome to Retrek. I'm Captain Jim. With me, of course, Sir Admiral Elliot.
Hi there.
And Dr. Squee.
Dragon! Which is currently attached to my microphone wire.
And joining us as a very special guest this week is Ed Zephyr.
Woo! Woo!
And for anyone who didn't go to the Sci-Fi Weekend, and for those who did go to the Sci-Fi Weekend but didn't come and see our show, Ed was kind enough to join us on stage and play Captain Kirk for us when we did the Shatner cut of Star Trek V. So amazing. We're not.
There's another character I've ever played before.
I'm sorry, I didn't need to take the wig back.
Also, there's another.
I needed it for later that night.
There's also another one which we've got from our panel. We've got Quark in the background there.
Oh yeah, there's Quark. So he made it safely to you eventually. Then
he did. I thought it was just better me not taking him on the train. I was so nervous to damage him or anything. But yeah, he's safe and sound now. Say again?
They made you buy a ticket for him to have.
Oh, exactly.
On the,
oh, God. Yeah. And with the rail fares, that's no laughing matter. I'm telling you.
So, as we said last week, because we've got Discovery coming up, well, it'll be out tomorrow in the US.
And tomorrow, UK.
Tomorrow, UK.
Is it? Has that been confirmed?
I checked on my Paramount yesterday. I think it was. I've lost track of days this week for all bank holidays.
Yeah.
But I checked and it said new episode coming forth, which is tomorrow.
So we're not talking about a specific episode of Star Trek. Instead, we're being a little bit self-indulgent and talking about what we did at the Sci-Fi Weekend.
Always.
And because we've got Ed on, we want to hear all about Ed and who does fantastic Star Trek-related things. As I told Ed at the Weekender, our goal with this podcast is just to bask in the glory of other people who are far more talented than we are. And that's exactly why we've got Ed on the show. So there is on our YouTube channel at the moment, there is a highlights video of what we did at the Weekender, where we've cobbled together all the footage that was usable but not foul-mouthed. So we've managed to put that in there. It's not as epic. But
we kept it relatively clean.
We did.
Yeah, we weren't too bad.
And you do get to see Ed in action there. Ed, tell us, for anybody who doesn't know you, what you do.
Well, what do I do? Everyone's always asking that. What do you do? Well, I'm an actor, and over the lockdown period, I think it was slightly before that, actually, I got into Star Trek, and I started to realize I looked a bit like William Shatner. But I had long hair and a beard, you know, when I began all this, and I was going to the gym and putting on the muscle weight that I'd lost. I was kind of quite skinny for a while, I kind of drifted into it and put the costumes together. This was the first thing I made, actually, just because I liked the style of. You see, I like the motion picture, and
so you did actually tell us that. Put your hand up as the only person in the room who has a motion picture.
It was the first thing I made. It was the first thing, and it's exactly how he. And I don't think you can really see the bio. There it is. But this is what I made it out of. You know, my dad helped me make that out of steel, stainless steel, and little bronze plates. But yeah, and then I remember saying to my agent, should I do this? Because I think I'm probably will become known for, you know, being Kirk. And he was just like, yeah. Yeah, why not? I think one of the earliest events was the Destination Star Trek that I went to and just spent the whole time
Yeah,
surprising people.
We got to interact with you with the last Destination Trek, but before that, yeah. It was actually when we were at the not the most recent, but the one before Sci-Fi Weekender, and it was our friend Adam came through, and he said to me, "He goes, you're never going to believe it. This guy not only looks like Captain Kirk, he looks specifically most like the animated series version."
Oh,
because I think it's just like the
actually now you've said that.
Like every time now, that's why I specifically see is the you look like the animated series.
Well, that's quite cool because you know the other thing that I started to do is because I got really into the whole Kirk and Spock relationship narrative arc that went through the original series and the movies, and it's just essential to the original series. And I actually started to write a book on it, and I will finish it one day. But it was a saga; it was just so much. And people started to give me, old fan works and fan art and fanzines and things like that. And I started I decided along the process that I needed to kind of conserve this stuff. There are some universities in the States that are, have fanzine collections, but no one really focuses on the fan art. And I think it should be in a way kind of shared. So I thought, well, I could put together a project where I rescue it and share it, take it out to exhibitions and things, because it's no good in a vault. And it's, a lot of it, I think, people have lost in attics and stuff like that, and it gets thrown away. But the art archive that I run, that I would love to be a museum one day, it's a mixture of fan art and production art, because my kind of beginnings in a way, or my formal education was in industrial design, and it was because I was interested in production design. And so I am a model builder as well, not as my job, but for fun. As everyone knows, I have a working one of these. But production artifacts are very expensive. Everyone has more money than me, so I haven't got many in the kind of the museum, as it were, except I have a few animation cells from the animated series, but not on hand. So I think they're over there in a special crate. So yeah, though I just wanted to say.
Yeah. I mean, you alluded to the fact that so you weren't knowledgeable about Star Trek before you started dressing as Kirk. Was it like completely new to you, or like what was your understanding of Star Trek then going in?
Well, no. What it was is I remember it now because I was watching things like Blade Runner. I'm a big fan of the kind of the ambient sci-fi, and I was looking for something similar that I hadn't seen a million times. And I think the internet search suggested Star Trek the Motion Picture. So I remember sitting there in the middle of the night, on this, on this laptop, very clear picture with quite nice sound, not my main sound system, but you need decent sound and picture for that movie. And I watched and thought, wow, I like this. And then I watched The Wrath of Khan and thought, I think I need to go back to the beginning and watch all of Star Trek.
It's a couple of days.
That's a monumental task nowadays.
Yeah,
that's quite a monumental task is.
I haven't got to the end of all of it. I think I'm watching Voyager at the moment, which I think I'm on season 3 and quite enjoying it. Every series has completely different characters, and it's a completely different thing. It's different relationships and different chemistry and dynamics, and it's very interesting. Yeah.
I saw someone, just Elliot saying, it's a mammoth undertaking. I saw someone on a film group on Facebook, and they said they decided to do a complete watch of all of Star Trek 3 months ago and have just finished. And it's like that. I'm not even sure if that
works. I'm not sure if that's actually possible.
I mean, you can't.
They must have been very pale by the end because they weren't going out.
Well, yeah, I'm presuming they don't have a job or a social life. But even then, I'm not sure just mathematically it worked out. But that's incredibly impressive.
I mean, we love Star Trek, but you do picture like in with Ultraviolence and the
Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange, you picture like the eyes like held open
as beam
Star Trek into the head.
I don't think I'd recommend for like a complete newcomer to Star Trek to go, right, to watch everything.
I think you could just about do it in 3 months if you're 24/7 watching.
Yeah.
Which is, that's...
I find it's nice to kind of, I don't know, relax to in the evenings. I watch a few episodes of something, but I watching so much at once. I think I did a bit with Next Generation. I kind of binged a bit. My agent was very keen on me watching it. So I was kind of watching and we were having this kind of conversation about the, this is really good. You're going to enjoy this. And I was like, what? And it was quite fun doing that. It's nice to have like a buddy, like a watch buddy.
Going to say, your agent sounds like he's a bit of a nerd, in like which we celebrate here.
Oh, he absolutely is. Yeah, he's great. Yeah, loves Transformers as well. He'll be watching it. But he is, that's the best kind of person.
So you mentioned, obviously, the Kirk and Spock fan art and stuff. So what is your take on Kirk and Spock then, Ed? Because I know, obviously, it was like the first sort of slash fiction thing was the Kirk and Spock thing, and there's all sorts being said over the years, and lots of people have lots of different interpretations on that relationship. So I'm keen to see what is your take on their relationship.
Well, I mean, I did a short film not that long ago. It doesn't feel long ago. It was a year or so ago, I think now. And I kind of used my understanding of their relationship as the basis for that and to underpin the characterization of Kirk, because as I said in the documentary for that, if you don't get that relationship, you don't really, you can't really kind of decode the characters themselves, because they're sort of intertwined with that and each other. And it's extremely hard. You see, this is why I was actually writing a book on it, because it's extremely hard to just kind of summarize what it is. But it's everything. I mean, Gene Roddenberry invented the word in the novelization of the motion picture. The pronunciation is debated, but something like Tehillah. And it means a sort of a combination of friend, brother, lover. And, there's nuances to it. I think the fact that he said that the characterization of the relationship is kind of hard to define, absolutely. I think, that was very clever. I think the creativity of fans, I think that is one of the things that has kept... Well, it brought back Star Trek, because a lot of the fans that campaigned for Star Trek to continue during the 70s were those fans who saw that relationship and thought, oh, goodness, that's amazing. And they did all these, fanzines and all this fan art. And there's a lot in it. It's a complex relationship and it's amazing. I love the movie arcs. You did the presentation on the movies, and it's the motion picture is one of my favorites for their relationship, because it parallels Decker and Ilea incredibly obviously and strongly. And so Decker, Ilea / V'ger, because V'ger is kind of like Spock and Decker is obviously like Kirk. But I think that's the heart and soul of the original series, their relationship. I could talk about it endlessly.
The other thing I was curious about, because as well in your act you do Rocketman, William Shatner, as well as looking into all the Star Trek of it all, did you do any extra research on Shatner just to get like his mannerisms and get a few other kind of like tricks of his to bring into the act?
Well, the weird thing is, I mean, I don't really regard it as an act. I mean, it's kind of something that I kind of happened and evolved, because I didn't set out to actually kind of do a lot with the character, except I did in my mind really want to show that it could be played on screen. But when I'm at events, it's different. I am playing up to kind of that side of it. And a lot of the time, you know, when people, you know, say do Kirk, they're thinking of Kevin Pollak. And, you know, I put that clip in the documentary. And but I, in terms of studying Shatner, I mean, I watched quite a lot of interviews and lots of cast stuff, all historical stuff. I don't know, just because I was interested in it. And I wouldn't say I was avidly researching. I think naturally I have a kind of a similarity to, you know, maybe some of the mannerisms, but I think also it kind of seeps into your subconscious when I don't really have a method as such, but I have actually quite a lot of training. So I think subconsciously I have a program going when it comes to acting, and I kind of absorb all these things with whatever I'm studying. If there's a character with a reference, that is, which you are fortunate to have with Kirk. But that, you know, I didn't intentionally, I think sometimes, I would say that the toughest part for me, if I'm wanting to portray the character like on film, is because I'm British. It's the accent, and the thing is, the time Shatner was Canadian, obviously, and his accent is very neutral. It's very kind of characteristic of the era as well, almost transatlantic voice. The captain's logs are very kind of, there's hardly any inflection in them. So, you know, it's very easy to underdo it. But yeah, I think that to me, that's kind of the bit that if I'm going to study it, it'll be looking at the voice. But, you know, and when I've done things before on camera, that's probably the thing that I'm most critical of myself over. But it's the easiest thing to fix, actually. So, you know, it's not really a big deal.
And I do, just quickly before I hand over to the guys for some more questions, I do have to ask about your background. It looks like you've got Daft Punk in their off-duty uniforms, I'm guessing, behind you.
So I, you know, in my quest to produce things, you know, to generate things for this kind of archive and museum, is I really want to have costume displays. Now, I cannot afford any of the costumes that come up, but I have my replicas, of course. But one day I might. But anyway, I keep trying to find mannequins that are my physique, that are kind of the Kirk physique, which is not 6 foot, and, you know, it's not this. But when I do see one that reminds me of Spock, I buy it. It is not a fetish.
Hey,
just that I, it's just
any
that
Spock's
I take
fetishes are welcome here.
But I wanted to preserve this one's modesty, and I have this tribble, this poor tribble that comes along when I need company, and I had to convince it heavily to stay there. But no, I picked up these quite recently, actually, and my plan with these is to the silver one I want to make into a warrior version of Spock, and I might invite some of the fans to kind of help design the costume for it. So like a pre-reform Vulcan, yeah, because, you know, the tradition supposedly of kind of a lot of the Vulcans comes from the battle. And, you know, I'm thinking he can hold a lurker where he's got the fan in his hand, that's preserving his modesty. And the other one, I had an interesting idea, but kind of, I'm kind of annoyed at the same time, because on eBay a while ago, there was a piece of production art from a motion picture, and it was Spock on Vulcan. And it was a picture of Spock wearing like this interesting meditation garment that was kind of string. There was really nothing much to it. He had some underwear on. It was this kind of string thing. And I saw this one, and I got it, you know, very, very cheaply. I had to collect it on the train from somewhere about half an hour away. Everyone gave me very funny looks when I was on the way back. But I thought to myself, I could use something like that and produce that unused costume on it. And that's one of the ideas that I have. But I didn't get the drawing, because at the time I was very distracted. It was a little bit expensive, and someone bought it. So I was about to open up to the groups and say, does anyone have it? Could they part with it? Because I would like to, I would, if I had it, I would definitely 100% make the costume and then exhibit the piece of art with the interpretation of the costume, which would be unusual, because I don't think that's ever been done before, and I could afford to do that. So
you're gonna dress it in a stringy, barely there top. Like, this isn't making it sound less Spock fetishist. That's all I'm gonna say.
Well, it wasn't my concept drawing. I mean, they didn't use it, which is a pity. You know, they had him in very kind of heavy long robes. And they were on auction actually recently. I don't know what they sold for, but I didn't even look at them. I am a resting actor, you know, and I've not been employed by the big studios yet. So, you know, I do this work, this passion, with every bit of spare that I have, and the generosity of people who are enthusiastic about it, and in return I share it with them. So yeah, that's how it works.
I'm just really interested in you said something there about Shatner, and I know, you know, when we did our panel at the weekend, we were taking the mick out of the films and stuff, but we believe it or not, we do actually really like Star Trek. And, you know, the motion picture, we do have some fondness for it. It's just, it's easy to poke fun at certain things. But yeah. I think one of the big misconceptions about it's like two-pronged, because there's a lot of misconceptions about Shatner as an actor, and there's a lot of misconceptions about Kirk as a character. And people see this sort of fictionalized, over-the-top version of Shatner, and he himself has leaned into that more and more over the years. But people have this version of Kirk, this sort of womanizing, all-action version of Kirk. And when you actually go back to the original series, there's a bit of that, but Kirk's a very intelligent, complex character. And I feel like, particularly watching your documentary where you're talking about it, you seem to have a really good handle on that. And I think, is it hard to get people to separate like the pop culture view of Kirk and Shatner from what that character actually is?
Yeah, I think so. And I think I come across that most in the conventions and things. Like I say, with people, you know, wanting to see the parody. And I'm there going, you know, no, this is what you would see on screen. Because when you do the parody stuff, it's too much. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Because when you actually watch the original Star Trek and Shatner, who, I mean, I say he is a master of subtlety. And, you know, some people laugh at that. And I go, no. Watch the Galileo 7 and watch him do the whole episode from his chair and the journey in his eyes. He's a great actor. You know, there's different levels to everyone. But yeah, I think what it is, it's a little bit of a, some call it a mass cultural misremembering. There's a pop culture version. And there's a wonderful essay by, if I pronounce their name right, Erin Horakova, who writes an essay called The Kirk Drift.
Oh, yeah.
And she basically goes through all that. And you know, I read that quite early on and thought, ooh, yeah, that's right. That's right. And you see, this is it. And people come to me and they go, yours is one of the most accurate versions they've seen of the character. It is not a parody. It's not an impression, because that doesn't work. But I think one of my, you know, aims, apart from to kind of show what I could do as an actor, because, you know, doing this is not easy, especially with something so iconic. So I wanted to show, because of the look and the, you know, everything else, that you know, here is an example of what I can do. But, you know, and people say to me, it feels the most accurate, or one of the most accurate versions they've seen, barring the original. And I think what it is about that. And it's not seeing the replication of mannerisms or anything like that, even if they are there. It's kind of the whole that you feel when you're watching the character, because it's what's coming from the inside. And like I say, if you know the character, you detangle it from, you know, that pop culture thing, and you actually play what is the original character, which you have to throw all that away, because it's not that. You have to understand the character's, I don't know, how he ticks. And, you know, if you go at it from a wrong stereotype, it will not work. And what people see when they watch, you know, someone like me on screen do it, in a moment, it just feels right. It feels right. And that's the point. But you know, I'm quite proud of it, really. I'm quite happy that people are happy, you know. And I sometimes wish that the powers that be could follow me around and see people's reactions. That, you know, I mean, if this was on screen and like main show, you know, center stage, I think people would absolutely love it, because you know, to see the character again alive in flesh is just, you know, it blows my mind sometimes. Like, oh, it's me doing it.
I mean, to your point there, I think there is something about, you know, you've said that you were acting before, but like what you're doing obviously on conventions, you're talking to people, you never know what they're going to come at you with. So you have to be very live and very in the moment, very, very in the character. Has that kind of like, was that tricky to do? Was that kind of something you worked on a lot, and has that influenced you as an actor kind of going forward to really kind of inhabit a role, say live like that?
Yeah, I do. You mean like the way people were kind of, you know, I have to improvise. And,
well, exactly. Yeah. When someone comes live up, you never know what they're going to say to you. You never know. And you have to be ready to be cut in.
Yeah. Just been asked, I have to be
someone's boobs or something. Like, you never know what someone in a convention is going to come at you with.
Me out sometimes, you know, but you know, other times, yeah, I think so. But the thing is, I'm not, I don't try too hard with it. You know, I think as an actor, one of the things that I was taught, one of the many things I was taught was, acting isn't kind of, it's not so much doing, but it's reacting. So if you kind of have the context, you have the character, and something's thrown at you, you just kind of react to it with that set of parameters, and you know, and that's what happens. I mean, I'm not, when I'm interacting with the public, I'm not playing the character, but in a way I'm just kind of leaning into it, so it feels like it's Kirk-esque, so that they, you know, there's that joy in the interaction with the something, but yeah, it's a little test of how well you can improvise sometimes.
We saw that for standard last year's Destination Trek when you found out it was the party theme was Riser, so immediately your top came off and your shoulders, and it was, yeah, that's what.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, like. That, of course. So, I mean, any excuse to get
the shirt off. To be fair, Kirk did get his must find it in his contract. My shirt must be ripped off at least half the episodes every season.
I think that's the cost of insecurity, because I'm like, oh, I've got to go to the gym, so when I take it off, I kind of look okay.
Sorry, go on.
No, carry on.
I forget which episode it is. It's one where there's a disease. And Kirk comes out of the turbo lift and McCoy goes to give him a hypo injection, but he rips the sleeve off completely to do it.
Yeah.
And he's,
everyone else has just injected them straight through the uniform. But when it comes to Kirk, he rips his uniform off him. So it's... Yeah.
I don't know. You know, it's the fun of it, isn't it?
You will show off my body.
I cannot rip mine. There is one of it. Oh, yeah.
Production doesn't have a sewing budget, then, I take it.
My production? Oh, no. I have other plans as well, because I wanted to do Mirror Kirk. And I have the stuff. It's just time, you know. The producer wanted to do a second short film, but I wanted to do, you know, think, okay, so the first one did this, the next one has to kind of show something else for all of us making it, and also narrative wise and fun wise, you know, what can we do? And it at the moment it's leaning into a Doctor Who crossover. So,
oh,
yeah. Because I think that'll be fun. I'm a big fan of that as well. So, you know, I think that would be what happens when the Doctor and or which Doctor you might say, but when the Doctor and Kirk kind of have a conversation together, you know, who knows? Who's this?
I'm not sure. A Facebook user. We don't know who you are.
You've got to get permissions to stream yard. It should be somewhere underneath the video of how to do that, if anyone's watching and wishes us to know who you are.
anyway. Oh. You've mentioned then your film a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Well, give us a plug for it. Tell us all. I've watched it. It's excellent.
I've watched and it. It's an excellent shot.
What I love about it, as you were saying there, is you've picked a quiet moment of Kirk, and it does just come across. You can picture it. I think you say on the documentary, it's like it's a snippet from an episode that hasn't been made. And yeah, can you tell us a little bit about it for those that have not seen it? And we'll put all the links and everything on the Facebook group.
I get that a lot, actually. I post GIFs of myself just walking around graveyards and things like that, and people just skip past them. And I go, are they just thinking these are... And I do, when I highlight, I go, this is me. And then they go back and say, oh, that's not from an episode. And I had someone come up to me at the con who said, you know, they saw the clip, and they said, I've seen every episode, and I did not recognize this one. And I realized, oh, it's not. And, you know, the film is, it's called test footage because it is a 5-minute scene and it really is.
That's quite flattering. I was about to say that's quite flattering to you that people think it's from an episode, but they can't remember which episode.
Yeah.
How you're portraying Kirk, that you're not doing it parody. You're actually getting Kirk from you. Mm.
And the thing is also, there are no fancy sets. There is, all it is me and... And the other actor, and who's incredible, Johanna Thea. She is just amazing. And it was shot in the Kempton Steam Museum at the bottom of a giant steam engine. That's where all the pipes are. And for context, it is one of the few surviving examples that is very similar to the engines that were in the Titanic. So this is it was the old pumping station for London, one of the old pumping stations. That's the thing. I mean, all respect to the fan films with the amazing replica sets that are just identical to the original. But, you know, I was looking at it from a perspective of, if you were making Star Trek now, which Star Trek is being made now, they don't replicate the original. You know, the sets are different, but how do you communicate the characters, that character, without having to announce him, without having to do this, that, or the other? You know, I always joke that you can put Kirk and Spock at a bus stop and it'll be entertaining, you know, that you don't need the backdrop. So for me, it was a case of communicating, yes, the character. And for me as an actor, that's what I'm trying to show. For those that, you know, can see what I've done. But yeah, it's a 5-minute piece. It was a test. It's almost a screen test, really. But it took a lot of work to put together a very fine quality, you know, sort of 5 minutes. And people surprising the amount of work it takes. It's not to me, because, you know, I know what films take, but people who don't know don't always realize that, you know, a tiny scene can take days. We only shot it on one day, you know, it's a lot of preparation. But yeah, it is. I thought, you know, I wrote it. I didn't intend to write it. I wanted actually to invite, you know, a writer or, you know, some fans to kind of help write it. But in the end, I know it so well what needs to happen. I just put it down and then reviewed it with the producer, and we said, yeah, okay, that works well. I met Johanna. I kind of wrote a little bit around her. She had a really good vibe. She had kind of like a Doctor Who assistant vibe that I really liked. She had this kind of energy to her. But I said I want her to evoke. I wanted to evoke Spock, but as if Spock didn't have that kind of, you know, control on the emotional side, that he was more expressive. So he was she's logical and intelligent, but kind of expressive, and that's why she gels with Kirk. Because she's very similar to him, to that character. And so in that moment, Kirk kind of opens up, as sometimes you do when, you know, you feel safe with someone. And I think, you know, it was inspired by those moments of subtlety in the series where, you know, you get that, those quiet moments with Kirk. There's loads of them. You know, you watch The Enemy Within where Spock's talking about, you know, the difference in how fascinating it is, and you have this version of Kirk and that version of Kirk, and you have these quiet moments. It's all in the eyes. So for me, you know, on the day, didn't think about it. you know, just had it in mind and then just kind of went with what happened. From a technical point of view, for a single cam shoot, that was continuity was pretty good.
And it just makes me think as well, you're mentioning it was shot by a genuine old-fashioned engine, and like there's a lot of this in Star Trek. They do call back, they've got kind of like not only past starships, but they've also got like classic naval ships, and in Star Trek,
yeah,
go on board the Enterprise. So it's kind of really nice that you kind of have this nod back to engineering history. Does that kind of like, did that feel kind of special?
I kind of didn't think about it at the time, because the producer wanted to use this suggested this and said I wanted to use this for a while. Their dad volunteers there, and you know, I thought that was brilliant, and that's one of the things I kind of miss, where sometimes sci-fi drifts very into kind of space and special effects and things, but I like the kind of the references to kind of those the naval stuff and you know, those other contexts. So you take it out of the space. It's great to see the space effects, but you know, it should be able to work in any context, you know, with the characters. And that's the joy of the original series. I mean, one of the best episodes of what people say is one of the best episodes, City on the Edge of Forever. It's set in, you know, 1930s New York. So, you know, there isn't a lot of space in that. But it's thought provoking, and that was
only because they were shooting this film set in 1930s on the set next to us, so it had to be set in 1930s.
Yeah, it was whatever they were filming in the next lot, wasn't it? Because that's where you had westerns.
Well, you walk down the street and it's
in westerns, and then you might have Nazi Germany in another one, and then you have Romans in another one, and it's because that was what was being shot next.
It's great. You can do anything. We'll do it in the job center next time.
They were very savvy to drop in quite, I think it's the episode Miri, where they drop in really early. They go, it's this theory of parallel Earth development, so planets can develop exactly like Earth. Like, okay, they've said that once, so that justifies it.
Well, I think not only that, there's kind of two things. It's not only were they really savvy with reusing sets which were already there, so they say production and it looked great, but also like anything which is on the ships, not only does it look awesome and stylistic to us now, even though that was kind of like just 60s style, but I think it's because the plots work so well. You know, any really good film, once the CGI, once the effects, once they kind of like this was obviously pre-CGI, when all that kind of fades away and doesn't look great because things have moved on, the story should still carry it. And I think Star Trek,
you know, I don't understand why people, you know, I'm going to say it's not many people. I think it's all these are kind of vocal minorities online. But you know, people complain about, oh, the original series foam rocks and things like that. And do you sit in a theater and go, this is so unrealistic? That's obviously a stage. You know, you suspend disbelief. You watch it for the value of the story and what it communicates. Because at the end of the day, I mean, spectacle's part of it, but it's about what the story communicates and how it kind of pulls in the viewer, you know, and how the viewer can participate. And you can do it. You don't need a lot to do it. It has to be compelling. And it's good when I was talking to someone actually yesterday about Jurassic Park, you know, the original Jurassic Park, and how that had a mix of practical wrong podcast, but you know, practical CGI, very early CGI, and how beautifully that worked, how atmospheric the T-Rex scene with the car in the rain, you know, how absolutely sublime and affecting that is to watch as a viewer. You know, it all these things should kind of complement each other, not take precedent.
Or if anything, I think some productions should use models more now, because they still look great if you use them correctly.
You still need a good story. Where me and James, we went to see Godzilla Kong this weekend, and we're talking the money they've thrown on CGI at that. We went to see Godzilla Minus One last year, which won the Oscar, and that movie would work without Godzilla because the story is so good. Mm. It'd work as a post World War II movie in Japan.
I'm a big
Sorry, we just got a little note from the floor. Like in Willy's Wonderland, decent models.
Willy's Wonderland did have decent models. Yeah. Yes, she did the watch. That was what ended up being our watch along at the weekend because Channel 4, if you're listening, put David Lynch's June back on because that's what we wanted to watch. No, I've seen, we haven't watched it for a watch along, no.
Oh, I was confused by all the notes we're putting in. I'm going like, I can't wait to see this.
What, you thought Nicolas Cage was in David Lynch's...
Right.
Just anyway, we digress.
Online, and they were meant to be doing June. And I saw, because I had some friends around, just every now and again, I just see the little Discord notification coming up going, it's like, some really weird stuff. I was going, wow, I've really got to see this film for all this.
I was gonna say, you know, on the story front, I'm a big fan of Black Mirror. You know, a lot of that is very Star Trek-esque, and sometimes I watch the original Star Trek and I feel like it's an episode of Black Mirror, and vice versa, I watch Black Mirror and think, this feels like, I mean, obviously the Star Trek episode, they know where it's at, you know. There was an episode of the Orville that was very similar to the ratings episode, to the nosedive episode where, you know, everyone's rated.
Yeah,
on an app, and they have a little button. And I thought, well, there you go. It's not just me that watches that thing. You know, you have that kind of storytelling with the original series. Here's me thinking, here is my ideal Star Trek, you know, the Black Mirror written writers and me playing.
You've also got How You Shot Your...
Oh, it'd be amazing. I'd buy that for a dollar.
Like How You Shot Your Shot, just using a shot in a old steam room. It's very much British sci-fi because Blake Seven, Doctor Who, regularly look for sets and they go out old buildings in the UK that look like they could be sci-fi-ish.
Well, that's right. You know,
it saves money. Let's go. We need a building that's got loads of pipes.
Yeah, there's a wonderful train station in. I went to visit a friend in France, and there's this train, and it's, you know, brutalist architecture, or, you know, the concrete, and I thought, this is absolutely, that could have been like a Klingon, you know, spaceport or something.
There's one of the buildings at Leeds University that they used to use a lot in Doctor Who and Blake's Own because of how it looks for the architecture.
Yeah, and this is the thing, you know, this is a thing with filmmaking, you know, you're constantly looking for kind of those opportunities to, you know, to use what's there. Yeah.
But that goes back to the CGI, and it's almost that's becoming a lost art to go out and find what you need because someone goes, oh no, we'll write it on a computer. This is what I want. We won't bother going out and seeing if that's there.
It's budget, and it's, you know, it's what resources are available, you know, and often it's a mix, you know. You have, for example, I worked in a nominal capacity on the last Indiana Jones, and it was the interior of the hotel that's in Morocco. So, you know, they mix it up all the time, depending on budget. And sometimes you use the location because you can't afford to, you know, have a big studio with a green screen. Sometimes the other way around. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're not going to drop that you're in Indiana Jones and not tell us a bit more about that. Sorry, Jim. I know you're coming.
It was a background role, and it was literally just coming out of lockdown, I think. And I, you know, because people like me, and your career feels torpedoed by this, you know, 3 year or whatever it was gap. And I thought, oh, I wasn't going to go back to kind of doing, you know, bits of stuff. But the thing is, I always say about being a film extra or doing extra work, you know, it's like live DVD extras as an actor. You learn a lot from watching. If you could just stand there on a Hollywood set, a big set, and you look at how everyone's shooting, you've got, you know, there was a Pokemon film years ago, Detective Pikachu one. I did that years ago, you know, and you've got all the different cams. You've got the camel.
You're
on
that as well.
What?
You're in Detective Pikachu.
Well, they're someone's going to do an Easter egg hunt one day in the future of me where I am in all these films. You know, it's like, you know, Oliver Reed, you know, and he did all these extra roles. You go through it and someone's put them all at IMDb. Mine are not, obviously, because, you know, background and crew jobs don't don't go on that IMDb. But yeah, Indiana Jones, it was coming off, and it was coming off after COVID, and I thought, oh, I really want to get back to doing something just to see a film set, and it was a Disney film at Pinewood, and I thought, what's that? And then I found out it was Lucasfilm, and thought, okay, they're not filming Star Wars, so it has to be indie. And it was, you know, got a couple of weeks, literally, you know, standing right there, you know, Harrison Ford, you know, all hell breaks loose in the thing and everyone's running out. You can see me for a little bit. They called me Shatner in costume. And they put me in it was set in 69. So, you know, I looked exactly like Shatner did. He's on holiday in the hotel in Morocco in Indiana Jones. You see Shatner in the back.
I'm telling you, Ed, I've now got the only reason to watch that film again.
I liked it. I thought it wasn't too bad.
I'm only busting.
I got three tickets. Popcorn, had a free drink from work and didn't go because I'd already seen it and thought, no, it's not worth my time.
I'll give them, they didn't do Aliens. So there's that.
I mean, but I have to say, the thing you don't see as a viewer, no matter what you think of a film, is the craft that goes into things, even something that you hate. I was on that set and I was looking behind the bar and they had, you know, such detail. They had the little slips that the waiters fill out. It's such a beautiful set, absolutely, and you don't see half the detail when it's on camera. It's just there to, you know, create the effect as everything's happening. But you know, the art of, you know, these sets, it's just incredible. And this is partly why I do this art archive, because it's rescuing the fan art, but it's also the production side, and I would love to have more production art, because, you know, just to inspire people to go into filmmaking, you know, for me it's incredible, beautiful art, set building, model making, practical effects, and a lot of people, you watch the credits, you know, sit there through the credits, because those people, those craftspeople are just, they make it happen. They're amazing.
There was a sort of like sideways question I wanted to ask you. You've said about watching through all the Star Trek, you're up to Voyager now. If you had to play, or if you got to play another Star Trek character other than Kirk, what's the one which you're drawn to the most outside of Kirk?
A real character or made up character?
Oh, if you want to go made up, let's go for it. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I made a joke once. Once or twice with people, and I said I could play the descendant of Kirk. But my joke was that it's the descendant of Kirk and Spock, because, you know, there is a big nod to that kind of whole relationship thing. But the thing is, in the future, I'm kind of thinking there is a potential kind of idea there where they're trying to, you know, how Khan's like engineered. Engineered ideal that someone tries to mess about and sort of create a bit like what's the film? Which is the film? Is it it's not a film, it's a comic, but Judge Dredd. I mean, the first thing I had familiarity with Judge Dredd was the Stallone film, and you know, he's an amalgamation of these people, these judges. Oh, and it's like Schwarzenegger in Twins. You know,
I was thinking Duvix on purpose.
Yeah, and I'm like, so they got Kirk and they got like Spock and they created, you know, they messed about, and you know, this character maybe doesn't know that they are. I kind of had an idea for a film actually based on this, but you know, I just slightly pointed ears, and you know, thing is, personality wise, myself, I'm a bit of a cross between Kirk and Spock. So, you know, to play kind of something that was a little bit somewhere in between would be interesting. But I think that's one way you could do it. You know, you could just have the descendant of Kirk. But I like the idea of that, because all the fans, they'll love that. They'll write loads of fanfic on that. Also,
if there was anyone who could get Spock pregnant, it would be Kirk.
I don't know. It would be the other way around. I don't know.
Although there was when we were doing, future, I do remember, you know, we were Destination Trek, and we were doing our Wheel of Trek, as it's now called, game. And you saw, like I said, right, Kirk's in front of HR, and I go, what's he in front of for? And you did say, like, well, they went down on shore leave and Spock came back pregnant. So now we filled in the backstory of this.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Well, the thing is, I suppose, because Spock is Vulcan, and there's not a lot told about Vulcan physiology, and, you know, we're talking about aliens in the future and everything. And the thing is, you know, this is one of the things I've sat in, you know, interesting kind of panels talking about Vulcan biology, and kind of the interesting thing about the fandom is to look at how fandom has perceived the characters with the times, because, you know, back in sort of the original days, maybe the 70s and the 80s, people talked about, well, if Kirk and Spock were, you know, together as a couple, they couldn't have children, and that'd be enough. And I'm thinking, hang on, actually now you can, genetically, they can do things, and you can have biological children, same sex. We're talking the future. You know, this is going to be easy. You know, anyone who wants to have kids with, you know, whoever, alien, they're going to be able to do it, right? So, you know, this isn't a big deal. They could have kids. I could be that kid.
Well, you've even had within Star Trek reinterpretations of the characters. Have you looked into the other versions of Spock? Oh, sorry, Kirk that's been on the screen. So obviously recently had, I'm going to forget his name. The young guy from Vampire Diaries is now playing
Paul Kirk. Wesley.
Paul Wesley, of course. Have you looked into him and into the Kelvin timeline, Chris Pine of it all?
I rewatched, actually. The thing is, with big Hollywood reboots, like, you know, the 2009, making that kind of thing is a different thing. You know, the casting is quite different considerations. And I read something how they were going through the lists of sort of A-list Chris's, Chris Pine and Chris Pratt.
Chris.
Half the Avengers are Chris.
I thought Chris Hemsworth, I immediately recognized him as not Kirk, but I thought, I got that it was his dad straight away. And the weird thing is, you know, it's really strange. Years ago, I had some headshots done that I never got them, actually. The person wasn't very good, wasn't very reliable. And they said, oh, you look a bit like Chris Hemsworth in these pictures. And I went, okay, I could see that. But yeah, he actually has a bit of a Kirk look to him. And I thought that was very, you know, you got it straight away. And I rewatched, actually, the third of those films. And I saw little details, like the fact that rocks and things didn't look totally realistic. I thought that was like a brilliant nod to the original series. Mm. And the feeling of that film was a little bit more like the original series. I think
The third one was definitely the most Star Trek of the three films.
Well, there was a cutscene where those rocks did form a monster as well, I understand.
Well, but the thing is, like, a Galaxy Quest is one of my favorite Star Trek films.
Yeah.
I absolutely adore that. As an actor as well, and I watched, I think it was Alan Rickman talking about it. And it was, yeah, because as an actor, you get all the actor jokes as well. It's like when it's the rock monster and he says, you're my advisor, advise me. And he says, well, you'll just have to work out what it wants. What is its motivation? And that's, as an actor, you know, one of the things, you know, what is the character motivation? What is driving you in this scene? And then he says, it's a rock monster. It doesn't have a moment, you know, and he says, you were never serious about the craft. And I just think that's brilliant. That's just such a good actor. But that's the thing. And this is one of the little things I wanted to say as well earlier. It was relating to actually the characters and the meaning that comes across on screen. And one of the things that people say is, what did the writer intend? And then I say, well, let me tell you something. In acting school, what we would do is we would do a scene, and then the director or the tutor would say, okay, now do the scene as if before this happened, you killed this person, or you had someone die in your family, or, you know, the thing that you're going in with is different, or the context is different. And then you'd do 10 versions of the same scene, and it would have a different meaning every time, with the same lines. So, you know, sometimes I say to people, look, you know, sometimes a writer, and I have sympathized with writers, you know, they intend something, perhaps, or they have an idea when they write it, but then when the actors act,
then it's interpreted differently.
Then the editor, you know, it's directed, it's edited, it's cut. And people don't realize the edit makes a huge difference. You get a lot of different versions. Yeah. So I just, you know, it reminded me of that. I thought that was an interesting point to make.
Yeah, when I was talking to Sarah Pimborough at the weekend, best-selling author, she was talking a lot about, like, she prefers to stand back, actually, when they are interpreting. She goes, right, you want to interpret my work, you want to put it on screen, you go for it. You know, you do, like, if I get involved, it'll be my version, whereas, you know, trust the people who are making their version of it, which is kind of
really Yeah, cool. It's inescapable because it goes through so many creative kind of filters until it gets to the final thing that it's gonna have its own life, and then the audience interprets it and they become part of the creation as well. So it's hard to sit there and say it is this when you know what's on screen is what's on screen.
We're half of this show normally when we look at the episodes, we spend half of the episode discussing how we interpret the different scenes and what's happened differently. And we've all watched the same thing and we've all got something different from it.
Yeah.
And we've even discussed how, like, us in our teens, in our, like, under 10s, like, and how we interpret it now can be vastly different as well. Like,
one of my favourite stories sort of about that kind of interpretation was... in the Tolkien's works, he never gives a definitive origin for the orcs. Like in the films, they say that they were corrupted elves, but that it's never firmly established in the books. And there's one of Tolkien's letters where someone wrote to him and said, look, can you tell me, what the orcs were? I want to know. And instead of Tolkien just deciding, like, they're this because I say they are, he took, like, this sort of taking a step back critical approach to his own work and said, well, let's have a look at what evidence there is in the books and let's see if we can draw out from there an answer to this. And I just love that idea that a piece of art is so many people contribute to it. But then, once it goes out into the world, there's millions of different interpretations that can come from it, and I do enjoy that. And, we've done, 200-odd episodes of this podcast now, and if we weren't allowed to do that with that...
233.
There you go. So if we weren't allowed to bring
this is our 233rd special.
This is the special for 233 episodes.
Don't you, Jim, for that.
Well, this is where to me, the whole, the passion that I got for the fandom, the Star Trek fandom, because I thought, this fandom is so creative. It does so much, And that is a community. That's almost a culture in itself. And,
I think that also speaks to how good the work is. Mm. The writing and the directing and the producing and the editing, that it can give something different to so many different people.
And like
we all love it, ideologically,
but... it always, reached so far, it appealed... the original Star Trek tried to do so much with the diversity on the bridge and, just the way it pushed and Gene pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed the sensors and, all that.
We've spoken a lot about this. Like, you can look back on it nowadays and think, that's really sexist or that's really bigoted. But if you look back at it from 60s eyes, what it was doing was so progressive to get past what the norm, what the TV studios would normally let you do. And you have to bear that in mind with it when you sort of...
You've got to look at things in context as well. I mean, you can look at things in context, you can look at things in abstraction. And what's beautiful is that I watch younger fans discovering the original series and seeing they're seeing all the relationships, they're seeing all the kind of subversive stuff in it. Whereas you sometimes get people that are very, very dismissive and go, oh, sex and this, that. And they do things like complain about the miniskirts. And I go, do you know your feminist history? Do you know that was the rebellion?
That was the women rebelling against what they'd had to wear. They wanted to be wearing that. That wasn't sexist. That was feminist.
And they wanted to show off. I think it was Michelle Nichols wanted to, kind of show off...
We're here to support our female sister. We're here for this. If they want to wear short skirts, we want to. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry.
So you said, Ed, that you're up to Voyager. Have you watched Discovery at all?
I think I have. I think I've seen three seasons.
Oh, well, you skipped season four then, which...
I haven't, it's like everything. I get to it eventually, or, you know, when I've got the streaming service, or when I visit a friend, or my parents, or, you know, I get to it. But I'm a big fan of Doug Jones. He is one of my favorite actors. Yeah. And because he communicates... This is a little bit of what I communicate, and you do it on that sort of macro level in terms of characterization like this. His characters are very physical. You know, the body is part of the identity of the character. And I feel that's a very important lesson to learn if you're not imitating, but you're kind of recreating another character that's very recognizable with the body... not the mannerisms, but kind of the embodiment and the way a character moves is very much part of their personality, their identity. And his characters, you know, that they the way they move is kind of part of who they are. Mm. And that is a beautiful thing to kind of learn from as an actor. I would say, you know, what does he do? I would say to someone learning, I would say, what does he do? Look at what he does as an actor. What is he communicating, you know, often without words? You know, often his characters don't speak, or the vocals are very different. I mean, Shape of Water, you know, that character doesn't speak, but it has a personality and a presence. And, you know, his role in Hellboy, I always thought, and just the way that character moved, he is just beautiful. And I loved, one of the things I loved the most, I loved seeing him without the prosthetics, actually. And I'm like, it's you. Oh, he's
just something you don't see often.
Yeah. Well, it was the choices he made as well, because like he chose to walk on the front of his feet, which is torturous, and he chose that to be something he would be doing day in, day out for 5 years now.
Yeah, a lot of cosplayers do that, you know. You see the
torture he goes through just because he wanted, like, that character would move like that. He would have like the swaying arms, which if you had said, yeah, you're going to have a character who's just going to have their arms framed behind, that's just going to look ridiculous. But, of course, it doesn't.
It doesn't, because he's so graceful.
And it's one of them where I've made a decision, episode one, I don't know how long this show's going to run. I'm going to swish my arms behind me. Right, you've got 50 hours to do that for now. 50 hours on screen, which is nearly 8 years of your life by the time you're done.
And they gave him something really difficult. So I've just actually started watching from the beginning, because I'm going to like catch up while we're watching through the kind of new series of Discovery. And in the first episode, they really hit the fact that he's like, this character lives in fear to a certain degree. That's kind of the threat ganglion and everything. And I think if it wasn't Doug Jones selling it really well, I think in the writing it was maybe a little overplayed, but he found a way of making this character very three-dimensional, because, you know, his first like good 5 minutes on screen is just talking about how he's scared of everything, which is tough to make that kind of like a three-dimensional character when that's all you're talking about. But it's like, it's just his performance of it really kind of elevated that.
Saru, sorry, go on, Ed.
No, I was just going to say, it just reminded me, it's very much in the vein of the original, of Spock originally, because that was by all means a kind of a tricky character, and how Nimoy kind of, you know, it could have not worked, but the way he did it, you know, taking the characteristics of this character, and, you know, there's the whole Ponfar thing, and the whole concept of the mate or die thing, a lot of people find hilarious. Now, where does that trope come from? Well, it comes from Star Trek. That's where a lot of the tropes came from. But, you know, you watch that episode and he absolutely sells it so well. It's the same, it's a kind of the same, you know, if that's how you kind of feel about the writing, it's kind of the same thing. You know, a good actor, it's quite a skill, you know, to sell sometimes what you're throwing at you, and something wild, and make you believe it. It's good. You
know? I mean, there's a lot of, it's very public knowledge, there was a lot of kind of writers change, a lot of kind of changes to Discovery in its early doors. And in fact, series in, they were kind of still changing the team behind it. So I think if it lived and died on how good the actors were, I think while they were kind of finding their feet with the characters, I think, in the writing sometimes. I'm not saying it was sort of bad from the start, but it's like I think there were certain bits which, if they had to go back, I wonder if they would write exactly like it was.
Yeah, I think there'd have been changes. But that's what I was going to say, is that out of all the characters in Discovery, I think Saru, Doug Jones's character, is probably the only one you don't see people arguing about online. Like, he's a universally beloved character within Star Trek fandom, and I don't think you can say that for any other character in Discovery. Which I'm not saying is a reflection on the characters, perhaps more of a reflection on some sections of the community. But yeah, I think that character's iconic in a way, certainly not to the same extent as Spock or Data or anything like that. But if you had to pick one character out of Discovery to say that this is a Star Trek character that will enjoy,
an iconic character,
then it's
after Discovery, we want to see more of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that also it's like much of it's due to how splintered TV is now. There's so much TV out there compared to when Star Trek was originally on. So it's very hard for a character to reach Spock or Data levels. However, I think I think he's perforated the kind of perforated beyond what most people would get from a show which, compared to original Trek, is watched by few people, if you like.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, I think with TV how it is now, unless it's something like Game of Thrones or Walking Dead that really did cross over into like the zeitgeist, you won't have something that has that effect, I don't think. Yeah, now
you need to be something like Tiger King to really cross
over. Well, you know, I mean, my dad, you know, because he was into the original Star Trek, you know, back when it was out, and you know, he reminds me, and this is the thing that people don't understand, is that it was so different to, you know, what had come before. And the thing is, we're saturated now quite a lot with, you know, very similar content, and you know, having something to make that impact is quite tough. I think, you know, something genuinely kind of different and kind of new.
Yeah, and it was different, and it was expensive to produce at the time, which
the people don't appreciate that. They think it was made.
No,
it was outrageously expensive.
But that's it.
It needed I Love Lucy money, is what budget it needed.
Well, the studio had two shows at the time launching at the same time. They had Star Trek and Mission Impossible, and they were the two most expensive shows. And I read like a making of book, and it almost got to the point where sometimes it was like, oh, they want to do this on Star Trek. Well, they can't do that because we're doing that on Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've mentioned this before, but Bill Tice, the costume designer, I mean, he did genius work with probably very little, you know. Sometimes literally. But, you know, you look at some of his, you know, designs, they're just, you know, they're so kind of clever, very smart, you know, work. But you know, as a costume maker, you kind of see those things.
I really like the sort of anti radiation / disease suit that they wear in The Naked Time, where they beam down and it's sort of red spangly, but it looks decent on TV. But I remember I saw it at Star Trek The Exhibition back in the 90s. And when you see it without the benefit of studio lighting and everything, you think it's unbelievable that they got away with it on screen. But
I mean,
it looked at the time, you could buy that was a radiation suit. You know, didn't have as much pop culture that now we look at things and go, well, that's what an astronaut looks like, and that's what a radiation suit looks like. You know, they were pioneering a lot of this stuff, and it was great.
I mean, you look back at the uniforms from the original series, like now, if anything, Discovery's latter uniform has gone back towards that kind of classic one color kind of outfit, and it's just so iconic, and it's it does stand up. I think, like, what you're wearing,
you mean from the pilot?
Well, like, I'm just saying, like, all the uniforms, really, like, they all are some version of that original series, really, yeah. Apart from maybe Discovery earlier series. And in Enterprise, we meant more for the blue kind of naval kind of look, I guess. But, yeah, that look is so iconic to Star Trek. It's still used today, and it still looks great. Like, still, as I say, some version thereof. You know, what it's wearing now, like, that top, it just looks great. It looks like you could use that on a production today, and it would not look out of place.
Yeah, absolutely.
You see, like, this was the first thing I made. So, I was like, oh, I like that. And for costume makers around, for cosplayers, this was actually very simple. It was a lightweight Fruit of the Loom sweater, so not the thick one. It's kind of like a thin cotton one. And I cut the arms off, and I used all the spare to make the folds and things, and to make the edges of this, and the dip, the longer bit at the bottom, I kind of added. It was just sleeves. It's on panels. You know, you can cost a fiver, you know, and a bit of work. You can turn things into anything. But
you heard Ed will make that for you for a fiver. Just send him a fiver at the end of the show.
The thing is, I mean, the construction is really quite nice. The line of the motion picture stuff, you know, people have variable opinions on, but the lines are really nice. You know, the admiral, the grey and the white.
The problem with the motion pictures, it's such a change from what we'd seen.
Oh, yeah.
With yellow, blue, red tops, very bright colours. It went to grey beige. And to me, the time it was made mirrored more what was Space 1999 from the 70s with the colour palette they use. Mm. And it's like, let's forget what we've done and let's go to this British-Italian show.
It's a very interesting film, but it's a very sort of clinical film in a lot of ways. As Ed said, there is some great stuff in there with the character dynamics. It almost feels sterile just to look at it.
There's autobiographies actually in that where you've got like the cast talking, and they admit that when they got the motion picture, they thought they had to take things really seriously. They were no longer on TV. We have to be really serious about this. And that reflects in the performances they give compared to what they did for the TV show.
It was always going to be difficult, you know, to kind of...
But then you go to Wharf of Khan and they've gone, no, we want what we had in the TV show. Oh, yeah. That's the chemistry we want to bring forward.
I mean, they are both like episodes of Star Trek, but different episodes, you know. Yeah. One's the atmospheric, kind of more thoughtful one, and one's, you know, kind of a naval adventure in space. Very, very, one of the
very
best.
Much,
it's a bit
Romulan one. What's Romulan one?
The Romulan one, Balance of Terror.
Balance of Terror. That's right.
That's Ralph of Khan.
Yeah, I would just say that this one, the one thing which you do notice is the 2001 Space Odyssey is like films like that have definitely influenced the kind of bigger space shots and kind of its shots. So
that was models. That was practical effects as well.
Models.
I wish I could find some of them. I would just love to exhibit a bit of those models, you know, but yeah, they do exist. Some of them, the originals, some do still exist. And, you know, again, it's a triumph of filmmaking. And I think the weird thing is
a filmmaker. Bezos who's got the Enterprise?
Who the Enterprise?
I think it's Bezos who owns that Enterprise.
Well, the ship. The action ship. No, but I was talking about Vedra, actually, because they built miniatures.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, big miniatures.
I build models myself. I know all about the models.
It's just some, you know, wonderful sequences. But you know, I mean, I think the gear shift in that film kind of fitted a narrative. And what I love most is that gap between the original series and that film and what happened in that. Because that, you know, is where my brain sits. And that's where, you know, I'm kind of mentally filling the gaps in when I'm doing the character, you know, portraying the character and writing little bits and pieces. I'm putting it in there. Because I just think I've said this before, but I think that the the character arc in that is beautiful. Yeah, I think Kirk and Spock in that, they kind of know what they are to each other at that point. They've stopped dancing around. They know what they are to each other. And there's that, you know, and I just love it when Spock comes back and Kirk's just like so hopeful.
Yeah.
And then it's like, no, he's not. He's Spock cannot, he will not give an inch, because if he does, he'll shatter. You know, he cannot open up. And then he gets knocked on the head, obviously, and, you know, comes to his senses and says,
this is what I love about the original portrayal, which I think they got right in the movies, and like the newer version has gone a different way with it, but I just love the kind of real rigidity of Spock, and kind of like he just couldn't escape his logic in the original series. There was something about that which I think was so pure.
The thing is with Spock is that I try and think about it in a way as if he'd been conditioned so heavily. He's half human, so you couldn't make him be fully Vulcan, and someone has damaged him. You know, he's a very damaged character, you know, and I think what he's trying to do, he's trying to undo a physiological block in his mind. Like, I cannot, you know, I have these passionate links with people that I love, but I cannot do it. I must run away and purge all my emotions because I cannot survive this conflict.
You know why? Because like Nurse Chapel broke him, like, by going off with Roger.
Well, that's what we find out in Strange New Worlds. So. Yeah. Well, maybe we will in season 3. We haven't quite got there yet.
Can I just ask you one more, Ed? Just one for the road as we kind of come towards the end, because I know the four of us could just guess an all night.
Yeah, we could forever.
But some of us need to eat. I just want to ask, so like having, I just find it really fascinating that you've kind of immersed yourself in this world of Trek, having not been so knowledgeable about it before. And it is such a community. What is it like to join that community, to meet all these people, and to kind of immerse yourself in that world?
It is wonderful, you know, and I wish I could give more of this. And I think that's, you know, the difficulty for me, you know, as an actor, as a performer, I know what I could do. And it's finding ways of kind of doing something with it. And, you know, I always say to people, I think, you know, my kind of hope is that people, there's loads of sci-fi being made, there's loads of fantasy being made, and, you know, dramas and things. And I'm thinking, you know, someone's going to make something similar, and they're going to be looking for the, not the archetype, but that kind of character that people will key into, and they'll really kind of, you know, love the layers of, because that's apparently what I do quite well, play complexity in characters. You don't really play it. It's just, it's part of the weird chemistry of being an actor. It's a bit hard to explain, but you know, I think I may well end up playing something similar in something similar, if not this character, that people can kind of have a similar relationship with, a similar kind of fascination with, as they do with Kirk. But you know, I'm really pleased that it's brought people so much kind of joy, and you know, I walk down the street. Sometimes I've just gone down Oxford Street and I've just dressed up, and you know, I get people running over to me saying, "Yeah, I watched Star Trek from when I was younger," and you know, it's so amazing. And they're like, you know, as if I am the character, and I, just kind of experiencing that, and then newer people, and to be able to explain, to introduce the character to them, but have that overall appeal that, you know, both the old and the new, and that, because you can kind of bring something to life that is identifiable, and it's kind of iconic. And, you know, I feel like I've achieved something, perhaps in a slightly unconventional way, but it still feels like an achievement.
Amazing.
No, absolutely. And it should do. I mean, just the first sort of knowledge of you and what you do that I had was at the Sci-Fi Weekender, as Squee said, when Adam ran over and said, "You've got to see this guy." But everybody was talking about you after you did that bit at the cosplay, like, and with such warmth as well. It was, "Did you see the Captain Kirk thing at the cosplay? Did you see that?" And that's what you do for people, you know, and so, yeah, I'm glad that you do realize that that is something, you know, it's not unappreciated what you do. And we, you know, when we asked you to help us out with what we were doing, you know, we just bowled over that you would agree to it. So thank you very much for what you did there.
When I asked you at Destination Trek and told you that I had a wig for you, and you went, okay, I'm an actor, and I didn't tell you exactly what wig until you got it.
Oh, and it's when you start going to Barbie Girl, I'm like, okay, I can play with
this. Just went into it. I'm a Barbie Girl.
Well, you know, I mean, like I say, acting, you know, you react to what's given to you, you your other partner, your set, your weird costume, and you know,
you're a great spot, actually.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And it gave me so much to play off, like, as God, which sounds very plain to say, but I was literally playing God.
And before we go then, Ed, where can people find your stuff? Where can they get in touch with you?
I mean, you can Google me, and most of it just pops straight up on the search. But it's on the production company is Verve B Media for the Star Trek Infinity's short fan film. And you just see that kind of 5-minute test of, you know, what's possible.
Do you want to add links to our Facebook page?
We'll put links.
And there's all sorts of other things. There's that clip from the first Sci-Fi Weekender of that little bit on stage, and that I actually prepared that for Destination Star Trek. I actually never got to use it. So when they said you've got a few minutes on stage, I thought, can I remember the lyrics that I rewrote for this song?
But like right from the beginning, because I happened to be filming it at the time, and I was like,
yeah, because you shot it. Yeah, you shot that.
Yeah, I shot the whole thing. And I would never do that for one of the stage. Usually you just record a little highlight, nothing against any of the other acts, but it's just, I couldn't stop recording. I was like, this has to be the whole thing. One thing I did just want to give a shout out to as well, because we're all talking about Sci-Fi Weekend. I think it's just appropriate to give a little shout out to Sci-Fi Weekend 16, which is coming up. Christina Chong from Strange New Worlds, amongst many other ones.
Christina Chong, yeah.
To give a shout out.
Yeah, we are really excited for that. We will all be speaking out.
Hopefully,
very much so. Yeah, fingers crossed if we can somehow wangle our way on stage again. And obviously, I don't want to give spoilers for Strange New Worlds, Ed, if you've not watched it all yet. But yeah, Christina Chong might be of interest to the Kirk persona, shall we say.
And also, Ed, you're going to have to come back on when we're doing a Kirk heavy episode.
Oh, absolutely.
So much fun.
I'll come back any time you like, you know, because, you know, I just talk, you know, Star Trek. It's a lot of fun.
When we do next.
If you're not talking to us, you're talking to the mannequins behind you.
Next original, so we'll pick a really good Kirk episode and we'll,
That'll probably be when we start doing Lower Decks again.
I write this book, and I, you know, I'm literally going episode by episode. So, you know,
that's awesome.
Just Ed stroking the merkin behind him. The dribble. That's fine. I thought the dribble was called merkin. That's where I got confused.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to suggest anything.
So, yeah, make sure you check out all of Ed's work. We'll put the links up to it. You know where to find us. We won't do our usual spiel, but we will be back next week with the first episode of Discovery. We'll see how that pans out.
What we're all hoping for from the new season of Discovery?
Well, I mean, better than season 4. I'm hoping it does it justice. I mean, because there has been things that I've really liked about Discovery. And like we said, Saru's a fantastic character. There's a lot of underdeveloped characters in there, but there are also characters that I really like and I'm really interested in. And I want to see that. I want to see a bit less misery, maybe.
I don't want to see any crying.
I mean, I don't mind some crying, but...
In context, like, don't have the captain on the bridge. I'm sorry, but, like, you know, just... You need to present something in front of your crew, surely. I want to see more of, like, what we had in Season 3. We went to this brand new era.
Season 2 was awesome.
Well, I'm just talking about 3 for the kind of... We went to this new era. We saw all these worlds, like, now from the perspective of where we're at, we haven't seen for hundreds of years, like the development. It's great to see where they're at. I wish they'd continue that in season four. So it'd be great to see some ones we haven't seen. What are the Klingons like in that era? What are other?
No, they went and played poker on a planet for an hour.
And Callum Keith Renee is in it.
He's in it, yeah.
And like Butterfly Effect, he's been in a million one things.
Yep.
I can't wait to see him as well.
Personally. But as always, we go in with positivity, and we'll see what happens. But
we're not doing our usual plugs, but can I just quickly, so we're talking about Sci-Fi Weekender, the interview which I'm featuring this week on Dr. Squee Show is with Lee Gill. It's the highlights from the Sci-Fi Weekender. So if you're there, you want to relive some highlights of Lee Gill, it's going to be up there tomorrow, drsquee.com or youtube.com/drsquee.
And thanks for trekking with us this time. We will see you next time on the Retrek.
Thank you.
LLAP. Bye. LLAP and drug off.